You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, in St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Kick-Ass News, Movie Therapy, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Around the world, people report monsters, but are they real? Join the detective of the impossible, Joe Nickell, as he walks you through investigations to reveal often surprising natural explanations behind some of the most famous cryptids and legendary animals ever reported. Using scientific skepticism, meticulous fieldwork, and historical deep dives, Joe Nickell seeks out hidden clues and real-world candidates that sometimes reveal that even the most unlikely monster stories may have a basis in reality. The Science of Monsters is the first book from Monster House LLC, the publisher of science shows Monster Talk and In Research Of. The revised edition is now on sale and includes corrections and suggestions from you, our listeners, and now readers. Sales of The Science of Monsters directly benefits Monster House and its podcasts, thanks to the generosity of its author. Pick up the revised Science of Monsters today at Amazon.com, available in paperback and Kindle editions.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
I had been hearing buzz about the independent horror film Late Night with the Devil, and when it hit Shudder, I gave it a watch. I was very impressed with it, from recognizing the level of effort to get an independent movie put together. But what really surprised me was how much attention to historical detail the filmmakers put into alluding to many real historical moments from the 1970s and early 1980s paranormal history. As soon as the movie was over, I texted Karen and Matt and urged them to give it a watch. And they, too, were impressed. And we decided to talk about the movie and its real-world analogs on this episode. Late Night with the Devil is an R-rated horror film streaming now on Shudder and Amazon Prime, and it stars David Dastmalchian as a late-night TV host who has incurred some debts to get to his current position, and those bills are about to come due on camera in front of a studio audience.
Monster Talk.
So today, we're talking about Late Night with the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
And
everyone's talking about Late Night with
it's for an indie film, I think it's incredibly well put together. We should say up front, we're gonna do spoilers here.
Spoilers.
I'd like to hold off on really diving into the spoilers for maybe the first 10 minutes or so, because some of what I want to talk about. Well, if we can. The main thing is, what was not clear to me from watching the trailer was, you know, this is a 1970s set film, and it's a horror film, and it is, as you say, found footage. And it's like a lost episode of a popular New York TV show has been found. But what was not in the advertising that really shocked me, and in a very pleasant way, was what a friggin' love song this is to the whole 1970s scene between the emerging new age movements of the 70s and its conflict with Psycop and the early skeptics movement of the second wave or something like that. I'm not sure what to call it, but yeah.
I think it's even more than that. I think it's free love, because there are just so many themes and references in this.
Yeah.
Just and bursting with them.
Leaving it out of the advertising, maybe that was a good move, because I think, you know, Kathleen is my wife, and she's sort of, you know, absorbed some of this material, but this is not her scene. And so I just kept getting more and more excited, and it's not her bag, baby. I kept wanting to like pause and say, oh my God, that's a reference to this, and that's a reference to that. So,
and we did, and it took us hours to watch.
Yeah.
There was lots of discussion.
It's so good, but yes. I really enjoyed it. So it's not a perfect film. But I mean, just as an overall, just as a horror movie, especially as an indie, I'd give it a B+ myself. I don't know how you guys come down on it, but I thought it was worth. I did not feel like it was a waste of time at all to watch it. So,
yeah, well, I don't know how to classify it. I mean, I give it an A, I think, just because it had an Australian connection.
It did, yes.
We're watching it, and then towards the end, I'm seeing all of this stuff about references to Aboriginal people and thanking them for filming on their land. And I was like, okay, this sounds like it could be Australian or it could be Canadian or something. And then to find out the directors, Cameron and Colin Cairns, I think you would pronounce their last name, they're Aussies. And when we get into these references too, there are some Australian references there that may be lost on the American Canadian audience. So we can delve into those as well.
Indeed.
Where to begin?
The way it's introduced, they give you I don't know how long it is, maybe less than 10 minutes probably, contextual entry into the story of Jack Delroy, who is the host of this TV show. And what we're about to see is a lost episode that is tied to some sort of tragic event, which we're not given much detail on. And so that's the premise. And so you get this sort of quick, very cool mini documentary about Jack Delroy and his rise to fame. And then not only his rise to fame, but oh no, he's having declining ratings now. And this is his last chance to pull things back. So this lost episode is really important. He's going to have some interesting guests, and he's also not just talking to stars. In this one, he's making a delve into talking to controversial paranormal figures.
Well, it's the Halloween show.
Did we mention that it was Halloween? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, the thing that we missed that I was really disappointed in was the costume parade.
Indeed.
Well, there were few members of the audience wearing costumes, comes into play.
The very spooky skeleton who never talks, I thought was like, you know, had an unusually well done costume.
Yeah. A lot of discussion everywhere, you know, online, on Twitter, X, YouTube, about who that is and who that represents. Lots of different theories about that, because we're never quite told who it is.
So I guess what we should talk about for just a minute is PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation for Claims of the Paranormal. And that's the organization that was put together by people like James Randi, Ray Hyman, Martin Gardner.
Yeah, yes, Paul Kurtz.
Paul Kurtz. That's right. But that period of time was like a really glorious moment for organized skepticism, because we had two skeptical magazines out, and we had these organizations meeting, and people were on TV. James Randi famously was friends with Johnny Carson, so he would show up there and do debunkings and face off against miracle workers and paranormalists mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And but it was also the same time when we had the sort of early emergence of the satanic panic. So these daytime talk show hosts would eventually become sort of the nexus of satanic panic information spread. So people like Donahue and Sally Jesse Raphael and Jerry Springer, but in the 80s, they're going to be doing all this. But in the 70s, it was Dick Cavett. And again, I think Donahue was still part of that scene. And of course, late night was Johnny Carson. And so it was not unusual to run into people like tackling these very popular paranormal claims on mainstream television show, also in a time when we only had three major networks here. So, you know, it was a lot easier to get your message out. Yeah. So they're doing the Halloween special on this late night show. And the main character, or I guess is the protagonist, is Jack Delroy, played by Dust Malkin. Is it David Dust Malkin? I think that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, he's in Ant-Man as the sort of the guy who keeps talking about Baba Yaga. I love that.
Like Baba Yaga. Baba Yaga, the witch. They tell stories to children to frighten them. You know Baba Yaga?
Whoever stole it, we need to find it.
Oh, you don't find someone like that. They find you.
Like Baba Yaga.
In real life, the actor is a big fan of late night horror hosts and in that whole monster. He was a monster movie kid like us. So, yeah. Good guy.
I was very impressed with his acting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he did a really great job, especially when what you know of him is mostly Ant-Man. Then it was great to see him step so far away from that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pretty flexible. And speaking of being impressed, I was impressed with the clothing, the wardrobe. I thought it was
yes,
perfect.
It really
1970s
and the color, the color, the palette was so 70s. The
fonts, everything. Oh yeah, very.
So they really
oozing 1970s.
Some of the actors were not as smooth as some of the others, but
seasoned.
Yeah. But also the for the most part the special effects tended towards practical, which I really liked. And so the only part that I really felt a little disconnected was when they sort of leaned into the CGI briefly for but other than that I didn't care. Like it just felt very 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 period. It really did. So
we're trying so hard to step around spoilers early on that we're not staying on track.
We're 10 minutes in now. Let's start spoiling. So let's start out we've talked about the setup is they're going to do this Halloween special and we don't exactly know how it's going to play out, but then they start bringing on the guests. So our first guest is...
It was Chris Du, isn't it?
Yeah.
The psychic. And I've got a minor quibble with him because he comes out and he kind of has, I think, shades of Uri Geller, a young Uri Geller. And he comes out to do his psychic spiel. And it's, I thought it was out of its time. It had some shades of Peter Popov.
Yeah, it felt more like John Edwards, like 10 years too early.
Well, 10 or maybe even 20 years too early, because I remember when I was associated with the Australian Skeptics, or it was around the 1990s, and suddenly we're going from these precision readings of Peter Popoff, where he comes out and he says, I'm getting a message from a Blake Smith, and he lives at this particular address in this suburb, and he was born on this date. And so all of this really specific stuff that's obviously, as we know now, upon reflection, hot readings, cards that people are filling out as they're filing into the audience. And so straight into 1990s style stuff where, oh, I'm getting a P. What does it stand for? And getting the audience to, help them with this. Yeah, this kind of cheerleading stuff of giving letters and exactly to fill in the blanks. So more of a cold reading style.
Yes.
And taking it from there, going out there, talking about common causes of death, that kind of thing. So that kind of mediumship was very 1990s. But I still think it's fine for the context of a fictional movie to introduce something like that, because that's what I think viewers are familiar with today, that style of psychic mediumship.
Yeah.
But certainly at the time, it would have been more hot reading, which we find out a bit later on that was taking place we discovered
they really played their they laid their cards out in a lot of different. It was interesting hand, I guess. Like, yeah, exactly. They're
covered everything.
Yeah,
they kind of, the thing is they kind of gave an excuse for featuring the cold reading.
Yes.
And that was, it was Halloween night. The veil was the thing. So it was the last night to commune with the dead kind of thing. Now, I don't recall, I could be wrong, but I don't recall them calling him a medium at any point. He was just a psychic.
I don't know how they referred to him. I think it was just psychic. Yeah.
Yeah, just psychic, because there wasn't a psychic medium. So they didn't lean into the whole dead thing other than the fact that it was Halloween.
Well, that kind of thing at the time. I mean, you did have mediums, as we're going to talk about soon with the Don Lane reference and Randy. Certainly that was almost evangelical at that point.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a mentalist act, and then it turned out to be a mediumship. Instead, you know, it really did. I thought he was setting himself up to be a mentalist. But it's cool, though, because they very quickly introduce another character who's going to be the foil for anybody who's going to claim paranormal.
Carmichael Haig, I think it is.
Yeah.
And I love how they call him a conjurer, because, you know, nowadays we think of these kinds of people, as you said, like as mentalists, like Banachek.
Yeah.
They're, you know, magicians. But certainly I know that people like Randy favored conjurer over magician. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy is so obviously a proxy for Randy. And his, I mean, he doesn't look exactly like Randy. All his eyebrows are similar, but his voice, oh my God, they nailed that.
Oh,
yeah.
The facial hair, that kind of thing. He certainly had the Randy vibe going. Absolutely.
And I didn't know. I was like, I was concerned. I thought, oh no, it's going to be one of those movies where they're making fun of the skeptics. And it's like, but not really. Like, I mean, a lot of what he was doing, I mean, there's some points where we'll get into, but I didn't feel like it was a disdain. I mean, they put so much effort into making this, you know, accurate to the kinds of things you would have seen. I think that, you know, this fictionalized version, we have to ask, what would happen if a real skeptic ran into real supernatural on a real TV show? And I don't think it would be quite like this, but it's something I always think about, you know.
Well,
fell into Pascal's Wager, it was a little like,
Yeah, towards the end. But so we had the whole Randy thing going, where he had a check for $100,000 and he was prepared to give that to someone who could offer evidence of psychic abilities. And I think it's interesting how you saw him as the skeptic, because Matt and I were watching some breakdowns of the movie, and people thought he was a real a-hole. People didn't like him. The skeptic, here he comes. It was a real trope of I don't like this skeptic. He's ruining everything, busting everything. And it wasn't until the point later on where he's trying to replicate the phenomena that they're like, oh, hang on a second, maybe he's right. And so up until that point, other people who aren't skeptics like us were watching it and going, oh, he's the bad guy. We don't like
him. He's the villain. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Twirling his mustache.
Well, my friends talk about me as being the guy who doesn't believe in werewolves, or, you know, but if it was clear that there was a werewolf, I'd be the one who also was able to whip out the silver bullets or whatever's necessary to, you know, like, I'm informed. Yeah. Like, it's not real, but if it were, I'm also prepared, right?
Right.
Which I've always felt like that was a public service we're doing here. So these are probably not real, but if it were, here's the things that they say would work, you know. So you're fully, you're ready either way.
We're covering all bases.
Yeah. So in the movie, you've got Carmichael, and now he's up against Christou, brought onto the stage for some drama, for some balance. And what does Jack say, Matt, where when he brings Carmichael on? It's something like,
pay him no mind, he's all whack, no wick, okay?
Delroy dismisses the skeptic,
Yes.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a Johnny Carson situation at this point, where, you know, bringing on Randy when he's got Uri Geller on the show. Or who was that other magician? I can never remember his name.
The
James.
One, yeah, I know the one you're talking about. Who?
James Heidrick.
Yeah, there you go, Heidrick.
Yeah,
thank
Heidrick.
You. Nice,
yeah,
work. Nice work,
him.
Matt.
Yeah.
Yeah, the martial artist. Yes. Well, and then I thought it was great when he was on, when James Randy was debunking Uri Geller with Barbara Walters. I thought that that was great because she was like, well, just how do you explain this kind of thing, you know, and my old friend, Randy, but how do you explain this? And then he does. And she's like, ah, you know, foiled again kind of thing. And that was a little bit, you know, every time that he would be like, this is how it's done. And, you know, he's having fun making his cigar disappear and reappear and things like that, showing that, you know, I know some tricks too. It did make it very fun, I think. But I think they may have dialed up the a-hole volume a little high on him.
Oh, yeah. He was not a very sympathetic character
At all. Yeah. And I don't think that James Randi would have also tried to convince Johnny Carson to get him in touch with, you know, membership in the Grove.
Right. There's another subplot. Yeah, that there's this concept. So again, things they pull right out of real life. The Jack Delroy character, it's implied that he's, you know, used a bunch of cronies and connections through membership in something they call the Grove, which is a clear, really clear reference to Bohemian Grove, which is a real place.
And I never heard of this before. Were you guys familiar with the Bohemian Grove?
Yes.
It's going to say Rhapsody.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is... It showed up in, I think I might have become aware of it through John Ronson's book, Them, where he's talking about all these different sort of fringe ideas. You get introduced to David Icke and some other different people. But one of the people that...
His name is Icky.
Yeah. One of the people you're introduced to is a young, up-and-coming Texas internet and radio personality named Alex Jones. And Alex... is still around and I believe has revealed himself to be a terrible person. But in these early days, he sort of like his first big claim to fame was he snuck into Bohemian Grove with a video camera and managed to escape with footage of what was inside. And it's a real place where very rich and powerful people go and do strange ceremonies, which would have been pretty common in the 1920s, but now seem very, anachronistic suspicious. And weird and elitist and suspicious and Illuminatiist and, you know, so.
Yeah.
So
Illuminati is definitely the word that comes up for me.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Went with a lot.
So are we talking kind of satanic rituals, that kind of trope, or are we talking about...
good question.
So much conspiracy theory around this that it's hard to say. I mean, you go to the Bohemian Grove Wikipedia page, and you can tell right off that it is very closely watched.
Yes.
You know,
people
it is
on both sides are all over it. Yep.
Well, the thing is there's nothing bad.
Like eyes.
Yeah, there's nothing bad.
Right. You don't see the word satanic or anything like there.
There's nowhere on there. There's no conspiracy theories about it. There's nothing. It is clean. And it says, oh, they mockingly do this ritual. You know, it's a mocking thing, you know, that they do this, you know, burning of care.
It does have some Masonic vibe to it as well, you know, because a lot of that stuff is psychodrama. They're enacting ceremonies. They're supposed to represent something. And in this case, they have this giant owl. It's been described as a Minervan owl, you know, giving it sort of a Greek sort of vibe. But they do a ceremony called the cremation of care, where you're supposed to let go of, you know, all your woes and worries and
that's
symbolic.
Still creepy, cremation.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bunch of rich people. One way to look at it is a bunch of rich people getting together, hanging out, drinking, peeing in public. And, you know, I believe it's exclusively male, except for the prostitutes.
It is, yeah.
So.
And that's the worst thing that's on the Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing is that it is strictly male. And that's like the, you know, because other than that, they're not, they don't say anything that implies racism. They don't say anything that implies, you know, it's all just elitism and sexism. And, but they say it in such a way that it's no big deal. And they have the, their motto I thought was interesting. Weaving spiders come not here, I believe is.
That line's an allusion to A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare.
It's supposed to mean don't talk business here. We're not here to talk business.
But that's exactly what it's about.
But that's exactly what's going on. But it's okay as long as it's in sort of like pairs. You know, if like two people talk business, that's fine. But any bigger than two people, no, we're not here for that. So it's kind of interesting how they try to make it seem less about connections. You know, you look at the, you know, they have these charts out, these internet memes about how what's important to upper class people compared to what's important to lower class people. And for lower class people, it's getting their
groups.
It's their, not low class, but in classism.
Oh, economic.
Economic.
Yeah.
Socioeconomic. Yeah. So they're worried about getting their bills paid.
Yeah.
And the higher economic class is worried about connections. And
contact,
that's really, it's really what this, you know, demonstrates is that connections is like the most important thing. Them having Carmichael going, oh, can you get me in touch with your friends kind of thing.
Even Carmichael. Well, can we talk a little bit about, so we're talking about the Bohemian Grove and the kind of links to this weird satanic-like, Masonic-like group. But the way it's portrayed in the film is more like an Anton LaVey style.
Well, that's the thing. You have the Grove, and then there's also a reference to a satanic cult. And they've got this girl, Lily, that they've captured and are keeping. And the way it's explained is they're going to sort of use these ceremonies to bind Abraxas, this demon, to her. And then they're going to kill the girl, and that's going to free Abraxas to, like, run, you know, wild in the world.
Rule the earth for a thousand years.
Yeah, and it is, again, this is a little bit like the Manson family. It's definitely got some Anton LaVey vibes. But they've combined this all into one cult. So it's like these, the satanic figures are both a, you know, a pop culture, you know, sort of LaVey style, just trying to get media attention. And also a real cult kind of vibe of, you know, hiding in a compound, you know, death by cop, you know, that kind of thing. So it's got sort of Branch Davidian vibes. It's got a lot going on. So all that mashup, you don't know how's it going to pay off. And it turns out like it all gets sort of merged together into a bigger conspiracy at the end, which is I was actually surprised by.
Yeah. It does show that they, you know, these two things were actually combined into one sort of secretively.
Yeah.
It's like, it was interesting, but it does prove that Joe Nickel is right. It is owls.
It totally was owls.
Owls or otters, but And I want to mention too, that just like Lily, I had one of those pinafores when I was that age around that time. But
hold on, I don't know what that means. Is that clothing? Is it makeup? I don't know what
clothing,
that is.
The kind of the apron like garment that she's wearing.
Oh, okay, that was super popular in the '70s. Yeah.
And '80s too in Australia,
especially among cult members.
Another thing that it references, this is the same kind of thing that was going on with Michelle Remembers, which is definitely one of the foundational texts of the Satanic Panic. And then, I guess we don't want to go too deep into the rabbit holes of what this movie references, because that could be each one of these things could be their own episode of like deep dive. But
totally.
But boy, oh boy, is there a smorgasbord of real references to things that we are interested in that we've talked about before. I mean, if you listen to a lot of Monster Talk, I think you're going to be well prepared to appreciate all these little Easter eggs whatever the satanic equivalent of Easter eggs is.
Bloody eggs. We've talked about Carmichael, but then we have some additional guests who come out. So we've already referenced Lily and her, I don't know what to call her, her guardian. Matt and I thought this was really strange. Dr. June.
Yes.
That she's this parapsychologist. And we, you were talking about Michelle Remembers and the situation there. And you got this kind of corrupt psychologist slash hypnotherapist.
Slash the lover. Patient. It's like, yeah.
yeah. And so in this situation, we just thought it was strange that he's this parapsychologist who becomes a guardian for this, this youth. And really, yeah, it should have been a, but it had kind of Barry Taft connotations. I was thinking of the entity a little bit. With that, the way that they did that.
I agree. It would have been extremely ethically questionable. Almost everything that she got up to.
And yet she was the one on the show that seemed to have the most ethics.
Yeah, for
which
sure.
Which is a strange
Well, and also...
She had that connection with Jack.
Yes.
I don't quite know what the...
It's so cool because she's apparently not made this particularly public that she likes Jack, and Jack seems to be kind of iffy about the whole thing, but Lily has insider knowledge.
yeah. Well, there was one moment where Jack was kind of like, you know, our lips are so close.
Yes.
She kind of pushes him away. And other than that, you don't really think they've got that much of a romantic history, but he does act like
about
he's, he acts like he's kind of been there before, you know, when she pushes him away. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's very vague. And I actually like that without them getting to, I didn't need too much explanation to enjoy that there was, you know, a lot of the stuff in here is just hinted at.
There's the situation with Jack and he's lost his wife. So I think they're really trying to play up that role of how dedicated he was to her.
Yes, to
a certain point. And then I don't know, again, how much we want to go into, but his relationship with her and what he did to her. Basically throwing her under the bus.
Well, let's say we're sitting here pretty close to the 30-minute mark, so we should probably start winding up. I think we could just go ahead and talk about the ending with a full spoiler warning, because I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about it. So let me see if I can throw a quick summary out. Okay, so if you don't want the ending spoiled, stop now.
Go and watch
the movie.
Come back.
Ultimately, it turns out that this demon that is in Lily is real and is directly tied to the ceremonies that Jack performed at the Grove. Things he thought were symbolic are revealed. He was basically told if you make a big sacrifice, you'll get everything you want. And it turns out he's thinking, you know, he'll have to work hard and struggle. But the actual sacrifice is his perfectly healthy wife suddenly comes down with lung cancer and he has to lose her as the price. And so he didn't even realize that it happened. And that's all revealed at the end. And then it turns out that the demon really wants to make sure that Lily gets sacrificed. And through either explicit use of magic or hypnosis or something, it convinces Jack that he's doing some sort of where is assisted suicide for his wife. He's basically giving a mercy killing to her.
Yeah, mercy.
But ultimately, he's actually murdered Lily on TV and freed the demon. So it ends with one of those chilling, you know, staticky video, you know, what's going on? You hear the sirens coming, and then it cuts out with, like, everybody's dead except Jack standing there muttering he wants to wake up. It's a very...
Yeah, it's like Dreamer now awake or something like that.
But if we can cut back a little bit, too, where we have... we have that scene with Dr. June and she's basically doing a hypnotic regression with Lily. So we have that scene where Carmichael is replicating the hypnosis with Gus, so Jack's assistant, and basically that the whole scene with the worms, you guys remember that. That was my favorite part. But I think it's interesting when they replay that scene and we see that we've all been hypnotized. So that yes. didn't really take place as we witnessed it with the worms. But then for Lily to say, well, I want you to go back and play my part again. And they replay it and everything is still there. But so just another nod to something historical when we see Jack's wife appear, appears, manifests.
Yes, yeah.
Materializes. And I thought that was really kind of like harken back to seances and that's the Silver Bell story with the materialization of the ghost.
Yes.
And the kind of ectoplasm. It had that feel.
It did, yeah. And there was kind of so many subtle things Lincoln, like that.
Yeah, the Lincoln mumbler pick. You yes. know, because she's standing behind him with her hand on his shoulder.
Yes.
Look very much, you know, like that. Definitely.
Again, that mashup of in the smorgasbord, the buffet of it's, of themes.
Yeah, it well, is. And they're all interconnected. Like, and they come back. And I was very impressed. For an indie film, it was, and you can tell it's an indie film because there's like 15 minutes of all the little logos of the companies they contributed to.
Oh, I almost thought that was a joke at first. I thought, yeah,
wow, no, there was so many production companies. And,
yeah, but it's hard to get funding, and they went as everybody apparently. But
I just want to talk about the Don Lane thing. But you, what did you want to say? Was it
well? Regarding? It was about the hypnosis thing with Carmichael. Is that early on in the show when they introduced him? They talked about his groundbreaking crowd hypnosis act. And, you know, that they did reference that before. So him doing that wasn't out of the blue.
Right.
You know, they didn't just pull that out of their butt. It actually was something that they positioned early on in the film. So I was glad right. about that, you know, that it wasn't just something, oh, guess what? I can do this too. It was already established. But yeah. it, to me, you know, I'm excited to hear your thoughts about the Don Lane thing. And I don't know how many Americans are aware of the Don Lane thing.
Well, Lane was American. I believe he was.
Yeah.
Now. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he died 2009. Yep.
Oh, there we go. So you were talking about all of these American references, Johnny Carson, Peter Popov, and Dr. June and Lily are Australian actresses. And there is a kind of reference I think that creeps up to Randy and a scene that happened about 1981, so kind of at the tail end of the 1970s. And so Don Lane's a talk show host, and he'd had a guest on regularly by the name of Doris Stokes, and she was a medium. And so a nice little old lady kind of character, and Don Lane really goes to bat for her when he's got Randy on the show and has a real tantrum, and just blows up kind of personality disorder style at Randy, who's actually not being an a-hole. He's not being a Carmichael. He's being just rational and fair. But Don Lane really blows up and like, I think smashes a glass,
wow.
Just hits it, knocks it off the table and storms off the set. And so that's a really iconic scene in Australian TV nowadays. To this day, people are still talking about this and just his tantrum that he has with Randy. So I think that was kind of incorporated into this as well.
Oh, it looked just like when Christu throws the glass of water in Carmichael's face. It was very reminiscent.
That was a nod to that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that was lost on me. So I appreciate that.
But if you go and Google that or look it up on YouTube, and you'll be able to see it. And he really behaves very badly. And Randy comes across as the rational one there for sure.
Neat. Well, I guess in summary, what we've got here is I think, well-crafted horror film that just took the time to just stuff itself on classic 70s paranormal/skeptic tropes, historical moments. And I really liked it. I mean, I just, I love the recognition, that sense of recognition for all these things. And I enjoyed the ending. It's like it was like it's not a perfect film. Like the found footage stuff kind of breaks down at the end because they're taking you through stuff that
could, the behind the scenes.
Yeah, like
yes. Well, did you notice the aspect ratio changed?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and the colors.
That was clever.
Yeah,
that was very subtle and clever.
Yeah, it's well done. I just like but it kind of doesn't hold up to a lot of scrutiny on that aspect, just the found footage part. But otherwise, all these interconnected story elements, I think, build a beautiful quilt that I've come to appreciate more as I keep thinking about the film over, the past week. And that's, to me, the mark of a good horror film is like it really, I keep playing around with it in my head.
It's in your head.
Yeah. And I think it did that very well.
I thought that one of the things that was unfortunate about it is there was a lot of they crammed it with so much that there were things they didn't need, and the things they didn't need was the CGI.
Yeah,
we didn't need electricity going everywhere. We didn't need her head to split open.
Yeah,
we didn't need any of that. It was I thought it was great just with the practical stuff and keeping it. Because that takes you out of it. It went too far in the suspending disbelief area.
Same vibe, exact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I feel the same. I thought it was great.
Yep.
Well, yeah, we certainly watched it, and at the end we were like, why didn't we think of this?
Exactly.
Our stuff. We could have done this.
Yeah.
That's the feeling we were left with.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think I told my wife, I don't think it's a perfect film, but I've never felt like a movie was more targeted specifically at me. Like it just.
And you texted us and said, "Oh, you guys, you got to watch this." And I'd been hearing about it too. People just talking about it on X, Twitter. People talking about it on Facebook. It was like, "Oh, we'll have to get around to seeing this," but I didn't realize just how well it was going to be played, and how relevant it would be to us and to skepticism. But certainly upon reflection, I have to watch it again sometime. And I think there'll be even more things that leap out at us.
I agree.
Well, it really shows that the whole cult thing is far from dead. I mean, it really peaked in the 70s. Rosemary's Baby really kind of up the ante. But, it goes back as far as, the pod people, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You don't know who you can trust.
Yeah,
and it really the 70s was huge in this area for these kind of movies, but then it continued throughout the 80s. In the 90s, you had so many that we've talked about before. One that came to mind was Spellbinders, that was around the same time as The Believers. Back in the 80s, which was around the same time as Serpent and the Rainbow.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we had a whole series of those, but it's really showing that right now today with, we're in another one of those, Age of Enlightenment kind of things where we think we know everything and that, we're not fooled by a lot of stuff, but we are. We're just as pathetic as we've always been in that sense.
You need to listen to last week's episode, Matt.
Disenchantment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and if you're like me and you haven't heard it yet, please go back and listen to that episode of last week. The thing is that I had wished, like you said, the sticks in your mind, and I had wished that it was a series that I could come home again the next night and watch the next episode. I wanted more. I wanted more of it. And I ended up finding on Netflix, there was a series, I think it's been out a little while, called The Devil in Ohio. And it is another one where there's this satanic cult and, in the background, and you never know who you can trust. The great thing about The Devil in Ohio is there's no paranormal stuff. It's all, that they're trying to make paranormal stuff happen because that's what rituals are for in cults. But it kept to reality the entire time. And that was a good sort of come down from this movie for me, is to be able to watch The Devil in Ohio to kind of, make me feel like at least I had something to watch. But the whole cult thing is going strong.
I know we're going to end this too, but you're just making me think too, when they were talking about the family in Late Night with the Devil and that cult. It kind of had Jim Jones vibes too. So again, yep, just so many references.
Totally. Yeah, it's going to resonate with you. I think for the our audience in particular, I think will really appreciate all these references. Now, some people who are skeptics can't enjoy a film where it turns out the supernatural is real, but I think we live with it's a horror film, and
I don't
it may be possible to have a good horror film where it turns out nothing was what it seemed to be, but I think here, you know, you're promised the devil and it gets delivered in some ways that I think that are kind of fun. So yeah.
It was funny to see Carmichael handing over the
that was okay. Yes, that's exactly what I was sitting here thinking. It's like that was hilarious. Okay, fine.
And it goes up in flames.
I wish that had been the that would have actually been really funny if that had just ended the movie. You know, like he's like, all right, we're done here.
He
thanks.
Could have ended it at lots of different points, just like this show.
Ah, nicely done. Okay, we'll call it there.
Thank you. Right. Good night.
Thanks for joining us, Matt, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Always
and
a pleasure.
Hope you enjoy the film too.
All right, I'll put links in the show notes if you want to go catch this on streaming. All right.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a discussion of the real history behind the fictional film Late Night with the Devil. The movie is presented as found footage and has a surprising number of analogs to real events and characters of the 1970s skeptic and occult scene. Links to the film and some of the events that we talk about in this episode are in our show notes. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Our theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys and contains no artificial additives or preservatives. Thanks for listening.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.